If there was going to be something that destroyed the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, that's obviously the state's biggest exposure from a monetary perspective.
Alaska's battles with climate change could be affecting its credit rating. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, December 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the U.S. State Department is taking action on transboundary mines.
We're very excited to see the federal government engaged in this issue and their response that they've made to us.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Would you like to play a part in the public media you enjoy? Consider becoming a member or corporate sponsor. Contact your public radio station to learn how.
In late November, one of the world's largest credit rating agencies announced that climbing global temperatures and rising sea levels would have an economic impact on the U.S. In short, climate change could become a credit rating problem for some U.S. cities and states. But even though Alaska is warming nearly twice as fast as the rest of the United States and dozens of towns and villages are at risk of destruction, the state's credit might not be affected. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney checks in with the state's Department of Revenue to find out why.
From rising sea levels to droughts and flooding to wildfires and more frequent hurricanes, Moody's makes it clear that the changing climate can have a very real impact on a budget. The global credit rating giant put out a climate change impact report in late November. It says that if federal, state, and local governments don't adapt and develop strategies to cope with these changes, their credit ratings could take a hit. And in Alaska, some of these changes are very visible. Villages like Newtok and Shishmaref are losing ground to melting permafrost and erosion. Glaciers are receding, Arctic temperatures are rising, sea ice is melting. Governor Bill Walker called the state ground zero for climate change. And the report highlights that Alaska has been more affected by climate change than any other U.S. state. But that doesn't mean that the state's climate risk is a credit risk. Devin Mitchell is the credit rating guy in the Department of Revenue. He says there's a difference between an economic perspective and a human one.
While it's obviously devastating if you're living in a community that's experiencing erosion and loss of land due to changing climate, and your community is in danger of disappearing, well, yeah, that's a very important issue to deal with. But from an economic perspective, we're not generating any revenue from an economy that exists in those communities. And so it doesn't impair our state's ability to pay its bills.
The state's ability to pay its bills is really the only thing that factors into its credit rating. To be clear, Mitchell says he thinks considering the effects of climate change requires a lot of nuance, and he isn't weighing in as for or against state or federal policy around it. What he is saying is that the Moody's report is looking at climate change from a purely economic perspective. And when you do that, he says Alaska is in a pretty unique situation, one where the effects of climate change are very, very obvious, but the impact on the state's credit rating is vague. For instance, looking at the villages of Newtok and Shishmaref, if the federal government steps in and helps the villages relocate, Mitchell says that's revenue.
If you spend $100 million to relocate Shishmaref or Newtok, then that's going to be money that's going to go into folks in Alaska's pocket as they help accomplish that work, which is maybe something from a human perspective you would wish to avoid, but from an economic perspective could be beneficial.
How could climate change affect the state's ability to pay its bills?
And if there was going to be something that destroyed the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, that's obviously the state's biggest exposure from a monetary perspective at this point.
That doesn't mean that the state isn't concerned about the economic impacts of climate change. The fishing industry is the first thing that Mitchell brings up as a potentially huge problem for Alaska. The state has the most productive fishing industry in the country. It generates nearly $6 billion in economic activity in the state each year. And that's just commercial fishing. That doesn't factor in guides and sport fishermen and charters. For Alaskans living in Kodiak, Unalaska, or Sitka, or King Cove, warming and ocean acidification could drastically alter their traditional fisheries.
As the ocean changes, what are those impacts going to be? And the difficulty is that nobody knows right now. But being aware of it and being aware of how fisheries might evolve is obviously going to be pretty important.
Mitchell says there are some big unknowns when it comes to the changing climate, and the state could take a hit financially. But for now, its credit rating is looking pretty safe. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
A man who helped craft a plan to use permanent fund earnings to fund state government has been appointed to the Permanent Fund Corporation's board. Governor Bill Walker appointed Craig Richards to the board on Thursday. The board is responsible for setting policy for the corporation. With Richards' appointment, 5 of its 6 members are Walker appointees. Richards is currently the vice president and general counsel for the Bering Straits Native Corporation. He was also the state's attorney general until June of 2016, when he abruptly resigned. Walker credits Richards with helping to develop the Permanent Fund Protection Act. That proposal is currently in front of the legislature. It would use permanent fund earnings to fund state government and cap the dividend program. Richards was previously on the permanent fund board from 2015 to 2016. He will take over the seat that was held by Larry Cash. Many rural communities in Alaska have been experimenting with renewable energy systems in recent years to try to lower cost. This week, researchers at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power published articles that look at how those technologies are doing. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravenna Koenig has more.
The analysis includes data from wind, solar electric, biomass, and several other energy technologies that are currently in use in over 100 rural communities around the state. Erin Whitney is one of the lead researchers. She says that renewable energies are helping to bring costs down in many rural areas, but there are still improvements to be made. One of the big takeaways from her team's analysis is that the cost of maintaining renewable energy systems, not just installing them, can put a real burden on communities.
Streamlining either that process or, you know, relationships with manufacturers or modes of repair is a key to making these technologies succeed and stay sustainable in many of these communities.
The research was made possible by a grant from the Alaska Energy Authority back in 2015. It was part of their effort to come up with recommendations for making energy more affordable in parts of the state that won't have access to the proposed natural gas pipeline. But Whitney hopes that this information will also be used outside of Alaska. There are many communities around the world with similar energy access issues that are also looking for solutions.
You know, it shouldn't be used as a manual, but it's a good place to start.
Whitney says that all the villages included in the analysis are cited by name, which means that anyone interested in finding out more about how a particular technology was used can follow up themselves. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks.
Anchorage skateboarders head underground to practice their craft.
I think guys up here that skate are what I feel are real skateboarders most of the time, because it doesn't matter where it is, what it is.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds, narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
The federal government is taking on the transboundary mining issue. The U.S. State Department now acknowledges Alaskans' concerns about pollution from British Columbia mines. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
In November, the State Department issued a statement saying it was aware of Alaskans' environmental concerns, and it said it was raising the issue with its Canadian counterparts. But that's as far as it went until now.
We're very excited to see the federal government engaged in this issue and their response that they've made to us, and to see the action going forward.
Barbara Blake is the Walker-Mulott administration's senior transboundary mines advisor. She's referring to a letter the State Department sent to Lieutenant Governor Byron Mulott. He's headed up the administration's efforts to address potential pollution from mineral prospects across the border in British Columbia. Blake says one important promise is to research what the two governments can do to protect Southeast Alaska watersheds.
They're looking at the gaps and limitations of cooperation between our two countries right now. And so we're anxious to see what comes about from their analysis and their review of any gaps or limitations as they currently stand.
The State Department will release its findings at an April meeting of the International Joint Commission. That's the panel that addresses transboundary water concerns. Mine critics have repeatedly called for commission involvement. One is Frederick Olson, Jr., who chairs the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission. He's also tribal president of the Organized Village of Kasan.
It looks like it's a good first step. Of course, as it says in the letter, to get the International Joint Commission, you still have to have the Canadians to support that.
Heather Hardcastle of Salmon Beyond Borders agrees. She's encouraged, but says there's a lot more work to be done.
I think first and foremost, we're looking at some sort of financial assurances mechanism to be set up so that those of us downstream of these mega mines know that appropriate bonding has been required of these mining companies.
She says officials also need to press for better technology. That includes changes in the way waste rock is held. Mines commonly store them underwater behind earthen dams. Hardcastle says that will lead to spills of polluted water that will harm fish and people downstream. That's what happened in 2014 when an eastern British Columbia mine storage dam broke. Observers estimated enough water, mud, and rock escaped to fill 2,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools. Tribal leader Olson says words can't prevent that from happening closer to home.
Not to be rude, but it's just a letter, you know, and that little piece of paper, if you printed it out, would not stop a Lake of Poison debacle like Mount Polly or something like that.
Walker-Mulott Mines advisor Blake says officials are looking forward to learning more about the State Department's plans, but she says the administration is not turning the issue over to the federal government. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
If you have young children listening tonight, you may want to turn down the radio for this next story that deals graphically with sexual assault. Anecdotal stories of date rape drugs being slipped into bargoers' drinks have been circulating around Juneau. Juneau police and an advocacy agency haven't flagged a clear trend yet, but it only takes a second for a sexual predator to turn your night and your world upside down. KTOO's Trip Krause has more.
Anyone can be a target of sexual assault. It happened to Mary Spain. 31-year-old Spain lives in Gustavus, but occasionally visits Juneau. She went out downtown with a friend one weekend in November. She bought one drink, her first of the night.
After I had drank that drink, I ended up becoming very sick. And I remember in the bathroom, throwing up, you know what I mean? And there was a man in there helping, I guess.
Spain couldn't control what was going on. She says at about midnight, someone led her outside. The next thing she remembers is walking into her friend's downtown apartment, 6.5 hours later.
And when I went to take a shower later, I could tell that I was extremely sore, and but extremely cleaned up. It's weird. It's almost as if I was cleaned up afterwards, you know, very roughly.
Spain said she checked her pants and personal items for evidence of what happened, but there was nothing. She went to the hospital and tested positive for the date rape drug, Rohypnol, or roofies.
And I also tested positive for chlamydia, which I know I did not have before because I had a steady partner and did not report it to the authorities. I did not report it to the bar. I was very minimal in details at what I told the hospital, too.
The Juneau Police Department estimates they've received about 28 reports of sexual assault this year. The count varies a lot from year to year, and they're likely underreported because it's so personal.
I was just afraid that police were going to be involved, and then, you know, because the tests they already had to do on me were very intrusive, and that was a lot to have to deal with after the whole situation. So I should have told them. I should have reported it, but I didn't.
For people afraid to go to the police or the hospital, AWARE offers similar services, counseling, and guidance. Swarupa Toth of AWARE is part of an interagency sexual assault response team. It's about five people with expertise in survivor advocacy, law enforcement, prosecution, and medical care.
And our commitment is to make a victim-survivor-focused group of people so that we come together at one time and allow that person to work with this as a trained team so that it'll be as less traumatizing as possible, because telling your experience right after you've had the experience is worse than a nightmare.
The team responds 24/7, ideally within 20 to 40 minutes of someone showing up to the hospital. When you're out, Juneau Police, AWARE, and other groups offer these tips. Take your drinks with you or make sure someone is watching your table. Don't accept drinks from someone you don't know or isn't a server. And develop an exit plan for the end of the night and travel in groups.
Yeah, I like pack mentality.
Yeah.
I say travel in a pack. You're safer. You can keep in mind that if a person is being predacious, if they're preying on a group, they're looking for someone who's vulnerable, just like hunting. Mm.
Mary Spain wants others to learn from her story.
I just want anyone to know that if they are in that situation, to please not close up. It might feel like you've been completely just violated and nothing in the world matters anymore. But I promise it'll get better. I promise. You just need to let it out.
Spain says she's been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and has been in counseling since her experience. In Juneau, I'm Trip J. Krause.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
ACPE's Education Loan Refinance can save you money and give you just one bill for all your private, state, and federal loans. The Alaska Refinance Loan offers Alaska residents a 4.95% interest rate with no fees. You choose between a 5, 10, or 15-year plan. Go to acpe.alaska.gov/radio or call 1-800-441-2962. This message sponsored by Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Eric Bork. This week on AK, skate or try? Alaska doesn't come to mind as an incubator for skateboard talent, but in spite of challenges, the skateboard scene in Anchorage is thriving. Winter is struggle season for a small, hardy band of diehard skaters, and recently, one of the only indoor skate parks in the state at a nearby Air Force base closed, forcing skaters underground. Literally. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes is himself a skateboarder and discovered a group of enthusiasts has started taking over a subterranean parking garage, breathing extra life into a scene that's usually hibernating this time of year.
It's a little below freezing inside a small parking garage with clumps of ice dotting the smooth concrete ground. It's empty, but for the deafening din of a dozen skaters throwing themselves at curbs, a metal bike rack, and small ramps they've dragged in right past the no trespassing signs.
In Anchorage, anyways, there's nothing to skate in the winter besides this.
At 34, Zach Crater is on the older side of the skaters here in the garage, a mix of teenagers, 20-somethings, and full adults. If the weather's too cold, or if the private security guards who patrol the area after hours kick everyone out, then Crater sometimes hosts a small crew at the tiny ramps inside his home garage.
It's probably the best thing in Anchorage to skate besides this place.
Crater is supremely confident on his board, charging into difficult tricks with the enthusiasm of a yellow lab playing fetch. He grew up around some of the world's most famous professional skaters in Southern California, home to the skateboard industry's top talent. But tired of the crowds and wanting a change, Crater moved to Anchorage 5 years ago, and to his surprise, found a weirdly strong skate scene.
I wasn't skating as much when I moved up, but meeting a bunch of homies up here and seeing how hyped everybody was, it just got me more hyped to skate.
Anchorage and Alaska more generally are anomalies in the world of skateboarding, which was born of California's warm climate and abundant asphalt, neither of which applies very much to Alaska. And yet, small skate parks are scattered around the state, from Sitka to Fairbanks, Nome and Unalaska, even Gweethluck on the Kuskokwim River. Anchorage taxpayers support 5 outdoor skate parks, but like playgrounds or tennis courts, for about half the year, they are useless, enveloped in ice and darkness.
So the skateboarding scene, as long as I've watched it in the winter, it hasn't changed too much.
Brian Adams is a professional photographer who grew up skating in Anchorage and taking pictures of his friends, chronicling the scene over the last 2 decades. Winter has always been an obstacle for skaters in Anchorage. There's never been a real solution, just coping.
Because we still have never had an actual, like, long-term indoor skate park in Anchorage, it hasn't changed. We're still skating the same old spots. They're still going.
According to Adams, even the parking garage has long been a semi-secret winter spot. Adams says the strength of the skate scene in Alaska has fluctuated over the years, but the overall caliber of skateboarding keeps progressing.
It's amazing what they're doing today. It blows my mind. Like, the things that we would never even think of doing.
Generally, the status of skateboarding along the rail belt is tied to whether or not there's a locally owned snowboard or skate shop. Right now, that role is filled by Blue and Gold, a store packed tight with colorful decks and clothing, nestled like so many other Anchorage businesses inside a sprawling strip mall. This year, it put out a video showing off the current crop of local talent, a big feat to pull off for such a small store, and the first such video made in Alaska in more than a decade. One of the star skaters is Tim Blevins, who works at the shop and tinkers with a snowboard boot as he rattles off Alaska towns he's gone to on skate missions.
I skated in Anchorage, Girdwood, Seward, Homer. I have skated in Kodiak. There's not much there. You know, we don't really have much, man.
Blevins grew up in Fairbanks, which has an even smaller, scrappier skate scene than Anchorage. He's quick to expound on why his passion is less of a sport than a lifestyle or an ethic.
It's like contemporary art. You take 10 dudes, you put them in front of a spot, and they're all going to look at it completely different. People try to emulate their favorite skateboarder, whether it's through clothes or through, like, tricks, but you'll never, ever be that guy. You're only going to be yourself. So you have to be yourself on a skateboard and do what you want to do.
For the thin band of skateboarders in Alaska who are at Blevins' level of talent, there is a stark choice. If they want to achieve industry recognition and possibly make enough money to live on from skateboarding alone, they have to leave Alaska. Blevins did live in the lower 48 at one point, and in his younger years, seriously weighed trying to make it as a pro. But the lifestyle required didn't fit with what he loves most about skateboarding.
I think guys up here that skate are what I feel are real skateboarders most of the time, because it doesn't matter where it is, what it is. It could be a curb, it could be a piece of plywood on flat ground, but they have so much passion for skateboarding that they will do it no matter what.
For Blevins and others, the same environment that forces skaters into frigid garages is what's caused a gritty creativity to thrive in spite of it. For AK, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Simon Fungsalmuth in Bethel. Fungsalmuth works for Alaska Airlines and is originally from Thailand.
Back in Vietnam War, my dad was a U.S. Army contractor, and he's from Thailand, and he worked for U.S. government as an Army Special Assignment Agent. When we lost the war, and he chose Alaska because he used to come in Fort Wainwright back in '60s to train in Fort Wainwright. So he fell in love with Alaska, so he brought the whole family here in Alaska. My brothers, sisters, everybody live here. I live in Anchorage for 35 years. This is my fourth year here in Bethel. I'm 100% Alaskan. I eat what they eat. I learned how to survive with local people. I met a lot of friends from different places like St. Mary's, Mountain Village, people that have a very small for their lives. So I learned how to appreciate what I have now and how I live now. So I learned a lot of things with local people. That's why I end up here for the longest time. My wife is a chef, and she loves to cook for people. And she's a very compassionate how she do it. She loves people, she likes to feed people. And unfortunately, we have to close it down because we're getting old. I raised my children here. I just wish everybody stay here for moving away. Of course, when the birds got strong wings, they like to fly. So that's up to them wherever they want to go. But as long as they're born and raised here, they know what Alaska's like, they will return just like salmon, just like ptarmigan, just like seagulls. They can fly all over the place, ducks, geese, they come back to Alaska. I hope my children, my grandchildren will do the same thing.
Simon Vungsalmuth lives in Bethel. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Zachariah Hughes, Wesley Early, and the interns at KYUK. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Eric Bork.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Rasha McChesney, Tripp Krause, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a safe and happy new year, Alaskans. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
The University of Alaska's founders knew that to build a great state, we would need a great university. Today, UA offers more than 400 degrees and certificates with campuses from Kotzebue to Ketchikan. They are leaders in Arctic and Alaska research and dedicated to direct hands-on teaching, whether online, in the classroom, or in the field. Greatness awaits you. See how the University of Alaska can help you achieve at alaska.edu/start here. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska. Colder temperatures are here, and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you of the danger of carbon monoxide, a poisonous gas that you can't see or smell. If it builds up in your home, it can be deadly. Be safe this winter and have a qualified mechanic ensure your heating system is working properly. Never run your car in the garage or operate a portable generator in an enclosed space. Finally, always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.